Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, 1080 Ti benchmarks, overclocking the Ryzen 7, and where are all the Ryzen motherboards anyhow? $105,000 in electrostatic headphones and Logitech's G533 Wireless 7.1 headset reviewed. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 405, recorded March 9th, 2017. NVIDIA 1080 Ti Madness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You've seen their teardowns all over the internet, the free repair guide for everything, and the ultimate marketplace for electronic tools and parts. For $5 off your purchase of $10 or more, go to iFixit.com/Twitch and enter the code Twitch at checkout. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that's here to bring you the most compelling, delightful, engaging, informative, and darn useful information on computer hardware and all the good stuff you might want to carry that has a computer in it, like your mobile devices. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, even earbuds now have computers inside of them. I don't want to go in that direction. What I do want to do is have our guest, announce our guest, deliver unto you our guest speaker, pundit, joiner, inner on this show, Sebastian Peek, technical editor, PC Perspective, aka PCPro.com. Sebastian, welcome back, man.
Thank you. Good to be back. How are you doing, Patrick?
I am full of mirth and good cheer. And I've heard a lot of audio this week, but we'll get into that a little later on in the show. You got ears on Logitech's G533 wireless 7.1 surround gaming headset.
That's right.
Do you feel that you are actually having a full 7.1 experience, or does it feel sort of smirched to you?
I think they do a really good job in the 5.1 area. And then when they try to do sound that's coming from directly behind you, that's where I think it starts to fall down a little bit. But I was very impressed by how accurate positional surround sound was when you're dealing with front and side surrounds. I have yet to hear an implementation, whether it's Dolby or DTS, that makes me think there's really something behind me. But in a game, you really do, like somebody calls out from behind you and you wheel around. It is convincing enough.
It's a good start. I'm really curious. I pre-ordered the ASIC X, after hearing them at CanJam LA last year. And in theory, they will ship sometime in the none too distant future. Oh, look at that. May 2016. So I'll be very, hopefully they'll ship in May 2016. I'll be very, very curious to, hear what they sound like, in the real world, assuming they actually ship on time. Cause they're doing multiple drivers and then they're measuring the distance between your ears to do an accurate, head-related transfer HRT function. I'll be very, very curious to hear what the final version of those sound like. So, lest we get too distracted, because there's a ton going on in this episode, 1080 Ti basically announced at Game Developers Conference. Ryan posted his review early this morning, and in fact, there's a GTX 1080 TI live stream going on with NVIDIA's Tom Peterson right now, which will be available for streaming later on should you want to get in depth with Ryan and Mr. Peterson. And they're also going to be talking about the FCAT VR testing tool that Ryan introduced to you last week. Have you had a chance to remotely see the performance of the 1080 TI? I know you're not in Kentucky at the PC Per headquarters.
Yeah, I looked at the benchmarks, and it's funny. What happens when you take a Titan X and you increase the base and boost clocks? This is the same GP102 core.
Right.
But for some reason, I've been trying to wrap my mind around this. One of the memory controllers is disabled. So you have 11 gigabytes of memory. We heard that, and it's like, that's not right. Like, these rumors, you know, they come out weeks in advance, and like 11 gigabytes.
Sure.
But it is 11 gigabytes. They up the memory speed, though. Like, they're clocking it at 11 gigahertz. So it's all about 11 with this card, and a very odd 352-bit memory interface. But yeah, plenty of bandwidth. The same number of CUDA cores as the Titan X, and as you might imagine, higher clocks equal higher performance, and it's less expensive.
That's what's kind of amazing to me, because you look at the specs for the $1,200 GTX, the NVIDIA Titan X versus the GTX 1080 Ti, and it's, you know, the base clock on the 1080 Ti is higher. The boost clock is higher. It's got the same number of texture units. It, you know, 8 fewer ROP units, 1 gigabyte less memory, a slightly faster memory clock, or 10% faster memory clock. That 352-bit memory interface, which saves them from not using G5X memory. You know, a touch faster in memory bandwidth. A same 250-watt TDP. Peak computing at 10.6 teraflops to the Titan X's 10.1 teraflops, and it costs $700 to the Titan X's $1,200. That's impressive.
Yeah, so if you're looking for the absolute fastest single GPU card right now, and it's kind of crazy that they're only selling it for $699. I say only $699. Of course, it's still expensive, and you can do a lot with less money, but it's kind of their flagship right now, it would seem. Mm-hmm. And it's, at least they've come down a little bit. It's more like a realistic number. We were thinking $800 probably. So it's a little surprising. Of course, you can't buy it anywhere, but I'll be surprised if you can get the Founders Edition day one for $699. We'll see.
Yeah, it's impressive, right? You're looking at a slight in a lot of the benchmarks, slightly beating the Titan X. You're looking at, as in some benchmarks, I'm looking at a 25% or 30% gain over the GTX 1080 8 gigabyte card. You know, probably 2/3 faster than a 980 Ti. The performance is pretty impressive. Whether or not you need it is an entirely different question. I think if you're running VR, if you're running 4K video, if you don't want to run SLI, this starts getting really compelling. But when you look at these benchmarks, I'm looking at Tomb Raider DX12 and the GeForce GTX 1080 Ti and the Titan X Pascal are not quite mirror images of each other, but there's so many benchmarks where we look at them, and the green line for the 1080 Ti and the black line for the Pascal are just, you know, kind of hovering over each other. It is pretty impressive what they're delivering for the money with this card, if you need a card at the very high end.
Yes.
And it's even quieter by a decibel, 2 decibels, 2.2 decibels at load than the Titan X.
It doesn't sound like much, but as we both know, 2 decibels is actually, it's pretty noticeable. Like 3 is really noticeable.
Yeah, it's fast. Ryan notes that usually 0 to 8% in favor of the GTX 1080 Ti across 2560x1440 and 4K resolutions versus the Titan 10. That's pretty amazing. And again, versus the GTX 1080, 2560x1440, quote, the GTX 1080 ranged from 2% faster in Grand Theft Auto 5 and Gears of War to 42% faster in Dirt Rally. The average improvement was 25%, including the 2% outliers. At 4K, that average difference jumps to 36%, with Dirt Rally showing the biggest gain at 50%. This is crazy. You know, this is a card that cost $100 more than the GTX 1080 launched at, and $200 more than the reduced price on the 1080, which means the 1080 right now is a pretty fantastic deal if you're looking for a high-powered GPU. So, are you gaming at 1080 or at a higher resolution?
I've been at 2560 by 1440 for a while. Okay. And it depends on the game. Like, it's, if I want to use one of my bigger screens, I have like three bigger 1080p panels here. And, you know, stuff looks really good on ultra settings at that resolution. But I personally like the look of higher resolution. I haven't got into 4K yet. I don't have a good 4K gaming monitor yet, unless I wanted to destroy my OLED. Just as a computer monitor.
Yeah, I'm kind of digging the not 4K resolution Dell curve monitors at this point. Those are my personal favorite, because I feel like 4K is just a big block. It's nice, but I actually like the kind of 21:9 feel when it's wrapped around, although it does triple columns rather than double columns, which can be kind of irritating until you kind of figure out how to run it. But man, so yeah, 1080 Ti reviews are out. Do they have a hard ship date on when it's going to show up?
Not that I've seen. Okay. That's the thing. They didn't have like a specific release date. I don't even see anything about pre-ordering. It's a little odd. It sounds a bit like a paper launch, but I'm sure we'll be finding out soon enough. I don't know if they're talking about it on the live stream right now or not.
Hopefully we'll find out. Oh my goodness. AMD Ryzen 7 launched last week. I got my chip.
Oh, you
still
got
haven't gotten
nice.
My motherboard. Yeah, I pre-ordered one. Amazon at that particular hour of that particular day of the launch day. Here, I can show it to you. It's right here. It's still in the box because Amazon has no idea when they'll be able to send me the motherboard. And you and I were talking about this in pre-show. You have a theory on why all the 370 motherboards seem to have disappeared.
I've been working on my own Ryzen build. And every time I think I know which one of the CPU SKUs I want, I can't buy any of the motherboards I want. And it's been like this for a while. So you crawl around online and look at different comment threads and posts, and we talk internally at the website. And it just seems at this point almost as if, after the initial findings with the different reviewers saying they couldn't hit certain memory speeds, maybe different straps not working properly on different motherboards for various memory speeds and timings, some other issues that we can discuss at length or not about its performance under certain circumstances. But it seemed like it just wasn't fully baked, maybe. Like, the platform needs a little bit more time to mature. Windows needs to be updated to understand the processor architecture, and Windows scheduler needs to be updated. But in the meantime, all of these motherboards now show out of stock. I was able to find two motherboards on Newegg yesterday that were available to purchase at all. And they were the two least popular boards, of course. Anything from Asus, Gigabyte, MSI, all out of stock on Amazon as well. I was even checking like the obscure kind of stores that I've nearly forgotten about over the years, and all of them are out of stock. So I start to suspect that perhaps there are some firmware updates being devised, or there may have even been... Who knows? What if there was a quiet recall of certain boards to be updated and then sent back out to the retail channels? So
I hope not, because I'm driving 103. I found one in Sacramento, which is about a 90-minute drive from where I live. The Asus Prime X370 Pro that I had pre-ordered but is missing in action. So I found one in a Fry's, which is a regional electronics experience. Yeah. If you've been in a Fry's, you know what it's about. If you haven't, you won't believe me when I explain it to you. But the in between getting it in my cart and entering my credit card information, somebody bought it. And so I ended up finding one in Roseville, which is now 103 miles from my house. That is the only motherboard I could find in stock. Everybody's, you're right, everybody's out online. So it'll be very interesting to see how fast and when they deliver a firmware update, if that's what's actually going on. Because it seems, I agree with you, it seems odd that all of the AMD Ryzen motherboards have just become unavailable. I would like to find out that it turns out there's going to be this amazing firmware update and all of a sudden the, you know, single core performance takes a big leap higher versus Intel's performance, but I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Yeah, if they discovered some errata in the processor or something like that, which would be a big deal, it would be easy enough to correct in firmware on the motherboard, and then you know, the problem goes away, and then boom, better performance. But we will see.
It would be nice. I'm not holding my breath, but it would be really, really nice. You saw BioStar. They're showing off the first mini ITX AM4 motherboard.
They are. They had they have a series of motherboards they call the Racing series, and they had an event of a few days ago, and they were showing this X370 mini ITX AM4 motherboard. I have heard rumors and just some suggestions that various manufacturers were going to finally go to mini ITX with AM4. And you probably know, there just weren't any AM3 mini ITX motherboards at all. Right. You had to go to FM2 and to get to that small form factor size. So this is great for any AMD fan or anybody looking for a small form factor and use one of these new Ryzen processors. And this is actually based on the X370 chipset.
Nice.
Which is kind of interesting. I mean, you don't really need the extra PCI Express lanes when you have one slot.
Well, that means you've got more space for SATA or more space for, you know, USB 3.1 connections.
In theory, yes. The picture shows four SATA ports, but yes. I mean, it's possible. But I just want to see some mini ITX boards on the market. Yeah. That was a big hang up last time around. Like FX chips, I don't know if it was power delivery related or what, but nobody wanted to make a mini ITX board for those.
Probably a combination of the power requirements and the cooler requirements and the market size at that point. You know, is anybody going to buy a premium enclosure or a premium motherboard for a part that's performing the way this part is?
Which that's true.
It's a good question. It'd be interesting to find out if it was an actual physical issue with the motherboard layouts. The Ryan also posted an article on overclocking the AMD Ryzen 7 1700, which does not solve the gaming performance question, although it improves it. You know, he's been probably weeping in a corner when he's not running benchmarks, right? Because he's done the 1800X. Yeah, there is no time to weep. He's doing the 1700X, 1700. That's a good thing. Just keep him busy and he won't, you know, burst into tears in the corner. And of course, he's got the GTX 1080 Ti review up this morning. But he started taking a look at the AMD Ryzen 7 1700 and overclocking. And it is compelling. And there's also some staggering issues with power consumption. Based on the Asus motherboard he had, and you know, running the running the sort of simplest settings on the Asus motherboard, we're looking at in some cases as much as a doubling of the power consumption, which is huge.
Yeah.
Or there's issues with CPU-Z's reporting. Ryan says, he's, quote, "I've been having conversations with AMD, Asus, and other motherboard vendors on the reporting of voltages and temperature for Ryzen processors, in addition to even clock speed. And the answer at this point is that we just don't know for sure. CPU-Z is reporting a voltage of 1.482 from the Crosshair 6 Hero motherboard running at 4 gigahertz, but I've seen that vary downward to as low as 1.417 volts, which is a pretty huge drop for a processor."
Yeah.
And then the using 8 to 64, the Ryzen processor seems to only be running 73 degrees Celsius under a full load. So it'll be interesting to see how accurate that turns out. But if you look at the benchmarks, there's like a Cinebench R15 single thread, which puts the R7 1700 overclocked at 4 gigahertz, running as fast as the stock 1800X, Cinebench R15, a multi-threaded test. Again, the Ryzen 7 1700 overclocked to 4 gigahertz has it again outperforming by a pretty healthy margin the Ryzen 7 1800X and almost up to the Core i7-6950X, which is the 10-core, 20-thread part from Intel. Handbrake, you know, running faster, again, than the 1800X stock. And actually faster than the Core i7-6950X, that, again, that 10-core, 20-thread, you know, $1,200 part from Intel. Excuse me, $1,500 part from Intel. So that's pretty amazing. $329, and you are getting better rendering performance than a $1,500 Intel part. I cannot explain to you how exciting that is for me.
Yeah, 1080p gaming numbers aside, this thing, these all of these Ryzen processors do phenomenally well in any kind of multi-threaded rendering or compression, video transcoding. Just incredible how even 8 cores will often outperform the 10-core 20-thread Intel part.
Yeah.
And but what's fascinating to me with this story is now I know he's getting very high voltages, but he's also using like a 4 gigahertz overclocking profile built into a motherboard, which is probably always going to err on the very high side of voltage.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we want this to be a stable overclock for you. So here, take a 1.5 volts. But other than the power issues, and I believe that certain power management, you sacrifice certain power management features of the CPU when you overclock like this. So you are going to draw more power than you would if you were to just get the 1800X. But it
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say but in terms of more power, right, the Ryzen 7 1700, you know, draws like 108 watts, peaks at 214 watts when it's overclocked, which is 106 watts over the 65-watt TDP that the part is rated at. And the 1800X at stock settings, 95-watt rated processor, overclocked, pulls 55 watts more power. So that's part of the reason why Ryan's really curious about the temperature readings, because, you know, it is crazy to realize, you know, this 65-watt R7 1700 is pulling 214 watts. That is a huge boost in the TDP. It makes me really glad that I finagled a water cooler, a liquid cooler, for my testing. That's a huge amount of wattage to draw off of a part.
Yeah, it's almost into the range of the, what was it, the 9590? That was the 220-watt TDP FX chip. It was basically an overclocked 8350. Yes.
The equivalent of 2 100-watt bulbs burning.
The problem with that processor, and I've tested that in certain benchmarks, was just finding a motherboard that could actually deliver that kind of power reliably, and there were very few. There were like two. But this story to me strongly suggests that we really have one Ryzen CPU. If you look at the 65 watt TDP, they achieved that by clocking it at 3.0 gigahertz. Right. If you clock it higher, it draws more power. The 1700K has a higher default clock and higher boost clock. And then again, the 1800K. And I'm sure those are binned to perform with the minimum amount of power at those speeds to hit those 95 watt TDPs. Mm-hmm. But under load, even the 1700 and 1800X are exceeding the TDP by a lot. You know, this chart under Cinebench, you know, the 1800X is drawing 155.1 watts. So there's definitely some headroom there. And I think it's just kind of interesting to think that you could buy the 1700 and just change a couple of settings. And as long as you have adequate cooling, then you're going to be able to get the same performance of the $500 part.
Well, just wait until we see what the $500 part does when it's overclocked. I hope.
Oh, is that the one you have? You have the 1800X?
Yeah, I went for it. Mostly because I wanted to see how much time I could reduce off of my rendering every week and see what it'll do with Adobe Premiere performance. Couple last thoughts on AMD Ryzen 1700. Even overclocked, you know, it's interesting. Single core performance is way behind. You know, like an Audacity MP3 encode, 211 seconds, which is a hair slower than the Core i7-6950X, that 10-core part, but almost 30% slower than a Core i7-7700K, a Core i5-7600K, or a Core i7-6700K. So as we mentioned last week, single-threaded performance definitely lagging behind Intel. And Ryan's got a good note for people who are arguing about the validity of testing games at 1080p. 43% of Steam users run at 1080p. 1.81% of Steam users are running at 2560 by 1440. And 0.69% of Steam users are running their games at 4K. So 1080p gaming is still a big deal. You know, and you're still even overclocked. You know, there's a good healthy boost over the Ryzen 7 1700 when you are looking at overclocking it. You know, again, it's faster than the Ryzen 7 1800X, but that's still, 30 frames per second behind every comparably priced Intel part that they manufacture, and even farther behind some of the less expensive parts going back a generation. So, but, you know, if you're going to build a 16-thread machine, maybe you should get a 4K monitor just so you can ignore 1080p gaming with the other 0.69% of the Steam users out there.
Yeah, this certainly will not stand in the way of gaming on a high-end GPU. This is not going to be a bottleneck in a high-end system. And it's going to give you amazing performance in those workloads.
True that. Oh, my goodness. We should take a moment to thank our friends over at iFixit. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit, with more than 22,000 free repair guides and 90,000 troubleshooting solutions. The good people at iFixit.com are experts in what? Consumer electronics repair. You know that. We've been talking about them for years. I love iFixit. I love the tools, I love the fact they make parts available, but I especially love the toolkit that helps you get the job done, the ProTech toolkit. I have one in the bench behind me. This is a really nice redesign of the original ProTech toolkit. They really got down to make this as easy to use as possible. And it may sound silly, really. They made the drivers easier to use. Well, actually, yeah, there's a canvas case that rolls out, a beautiful collection of steel bits and a nice anodized aluminum driver handle inside the 64-bit driver kit. And you pull the lid off. It's magnetic, which is great. You know, you don't have to like slide it out of a strap on the case and then undo the latch and get it open and then pull out a collection of 5 bits and then pull out the one collection you want. All the bits beautifully separated and a great collection of tools, electrostatic safe tweezers, reverse tweezers, spudgers, picks, a suction cup to get the display off of a phone, a metal spudger, and the most excellent Jimmy Pry tool. That's an iFixit design right there. ProTech Toolkit is the last precision toolkit you'll ever need. That's why the ProTech Toolkit is backed by a lifetime guarantee. I use it 2 or 3 times a week easily, and not just for consumer electronics. I've fixed toys. I've fixed toilets. I've fixed the dishwasher. I've worked on my car. It is incredibly useful. And, hey, it's backed by a lifetime guarantee. These are nice tools. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the magnet. Inside there, if you pull the bits out, there's a magnet that the bit case, the bit driver kit, the 64-bit driver kit, latches onto. And it's magnetic. So as you're pulling something apart, you can drop your screws onto that big piece of magnet in the tool roll, the canvas case that the ProTech Toolkit comes in. It's good stuff, people. Speaking of which, the people at iFixit, they never stop repairing. And with this toolkit under your belt, you won't either. Head over to iFixit.com/twit and use the code TWITCH at checkout to save $5 on your purchase of $10 or more. Even if you don't buy anything, you can still use iFixit's free repair guides, troubleshooting answers forum, and other educational resources on their website anytime your tech has an accident. We want to thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's good stuff, people. And, you know, it's nice to keep things out of the landfill. Reduce, reuse, recycle. iFixit can help you with that. Thank you, iFixit. iFixit.com/twit and use the code Twitch. Save $5 on your purchase of $10 or more. Oh, my goodness. We started to talk a little bit about the G533 Wireless 7.1 Surround Gaming Headset Review. You've been really, really impressed with the audio performance of the last couple of Logitech headsets that you've gotten yours on.
Yeah, the G533s have the same, they call it their Pro G driver. It's a 40-millimeter driver that the Artemis Spectrum, which is their ultra-high-end headsets, had, and I reviewed those last year. And even though they're, 40 millimeter, I know there's some 50 millimeter stuff out there, and then of course there's the multi-driver, but I was very impressed by the ability of these things to produce deep bass and control it. And I know that the build, the actual housing, has a lot to do with that and the performance of these. But the 533s, even though I think maybe the bass performance is not quite as deep as it was in the Artemis Spectrum with the same driver, it was still plenty deep to be convincing for like low frequency effects. And the overall sound is fantastic. These drivers do a really good job of giving you a kind of a neutral, clean sound. And right, even the inexpensive Logitech headset I recently reviewed, I think there was the G531, I want to say. It's their $60 headset. That sounded fantastic. That was on par with going out and buying like some great SR60s to just listen to two-channel music. So they do a really good job with just clean, neutral, accurate sound. They don't have any specific characteristics that stand out to me. They're not bright. They're not dark. They don't have a really warm sound to them. The G533 was a touch on the warmer side than other Logitech headphones I've heard recently, but compared to something like the Monster, the Fatality by Monster gaming headset, which is very warm sounding, very kind of bass heavy, these are quite neutral. So if you, and you can play around with the EQ. I like to listen to music flat, but some of the movie effects and things were, you know, quite, they're plenty spacious and everything, and the sound is very accurate from these. So I was obviously very impressed. And the build quality is very high. These are the least creaky plastic headphones that I've tried.
Nice.
You can kind of swivel them around and turn them and twist them, and you'll hear minimal, if any, creaking sounds. I didn't hear any when they were actually on my head.
That's a big plus, because some of them tend to sort of just make noise anytime you move, which can be a little frustrating.
Right, you twitch a little bit, or you even just talking sometimes will cause them to just kind of creak a little bit in your ear, but these were very quiet.
Yay. Oh my goodness. I had a crazy experience a couple weeks ago now. I talked about it a little bit on AVXL this week with Robert Heron, but wanted to bring it up with you because I know you may at this point be an even bigger headphone geek than I am. But I got to join some people down at the Source AV Design Group, which is in Torrance, California. I don't know if we have pictures from their website, but they make amazing high-end home theater systems. They've got, I think I saw 5 home theater rooms inside their building. And I have a picture I mean to send to you, Sebastian, that they have like 30 sets of headphones in stock on a wall that you can listen to.
And, oh, nice.
Oh, my goodness. Everything from like the 4th Focal Utopias, the, you know, Hi-Fi Man HE1000, you know, and all the way down to sort of normal human being priced headphones and tons of amplifiers to play with. Focal's complete lineup of speakers. It's a really amazing place to hear just how amazing a home theater can be. I mean, they're sort of like in their good, better, best home theater, their best home theater, the over-the-top, amazing. We filled it with Macintosh speakers and massive JL audio subwoofers and an amazing room treatment and lighting system and automation system and music system and movie collection. That's like $1 million home theater. So if I start robbing banks, I know where I'm going to get my home theater built. But I was there to actually listen to three sets of electrostatic headphones. They were doing basically a demo day for their customers. And they brought in three electrostatic headphones. And if you're not familiar with electrostatic headphones, it's kind of the for a lot of audio enthusiasts, electrostatics are kind of the grail, right? Stax has been making them in Japan since 1959, but Stax doesn't currently bring them into the United States. And some of the big news in electrostatics took place when Sennheiser launched the Orpheus last year, the Sennheiser HE1, which is their, it's a moonshot. It is a crazy machine. There's when you look at it, it's marble, and there's a storage case built in for the headphones, and then there's eight circles in the upper right corner. And when you sort of lift the lid, the tubes that are under those circles pop up, and the machine powers up, and it's pretty obscene. You have eight DACs. Four for the left channel, four for the right channel. Again, it's a solid block of Carrera marble. The power buttons and stuff pop out of the front when you power it up. It's magnificent. It is ridiculous, right? It's a $55,000 headphone amp DAC combination, which they seem to be selling as many of as they can make. But for a lot of really serious headphone geeks I've talked to, it's kind of the cutting edge. And electrostatics, to bring it back to electrostatics for a second. So electrostatics, we talked a bunch about planar magnetics, right? So typical speaker, there's a magnet which surrounds a voice coil, copper wire, which is attached to a cone. The audio signal is sent through the copper wire. That electrical signal pushes against the magnet, which moves the cone, which moves the air, and you hear things in your ears. That's like a classic speaker. Planar magnetics, there's a plastic film, a diaphragm, an incredibly thin piece of plastic with a flat voice coil either embedded into it or glued onto it. The signal runs through the diaphragms, and it works against magnets on either side of the diaphragm or in some of the Odyssey designs on one side of the diaphragm. And that big, fast, flat wall of plastic moves the air into your ears and gives you this, tremendous bass, huge soundstage, anywhere from like the Fostex T50 RPs, they cost about $140, so they don't have a huge low end unless you start modifying them, up to the Hi-Fi Man HE400S, which is, I want to say, the wire cutter's pick right now for over-ear headphones. Mr. Speaker's Etherflow are pretty amazing. They're $1,800. These are all pretty serious audio geek headphones. And when you step up to electrostatics, you literally have this incredibly thin piece of plastic. I'm going to call it plastic, and that's saying unnecessary things about the diaphragm with stators or magnets fore and aft of it. And the audio signals fed to the stators, but the diaphragm holds a charge and gets pulled. And what you end up with is, because there's not even a voice coil embedded into this incredibly thin, tight, stretched piece of plastic, you end up with this incredibly responsive and dynamic, fast moving, thing that moves the air into your ears. A lot of people consider these to be the most faithful or accurate, transducers, things that turn the signal into the sound you can hear, that are available. They call it a wire with gain, right? It's just the purest reproduction of the audio. If you can get your hands on them, they are, if you even get like the original Stax, which are not really considered to be as amazing as they used to be, they're like $5,200 without the amp and $5,000 with the amp. So I got to hear the Sennheisers, which a lot of people consider the state of the art, you know, and it's an experience, right? Because all the craziness going, you know, it's like the ultimate case modder meets, you know, engineering confection. They're pretty outrageous, right? That's the eight tubes that take the signal from the eight DACs and then send them into the electrostatics. You know, and electrostatics are a little crazy. In order to move or charge that diaphragm, you're looking at like a 580 volts running into running into your headphones, which is why people were really amazed when Shure did their electrostatic earbuds a couple years ago. So it's a pretty amazing experience to listen to those. It is, you know, probably as close as you're going to get to being in the studio after the mix, which doesn't really happen, right? Because music is created and then mastered, then released. The Shangri-Las, which are from Hi-Fi Man, it looks kind of like a battleship or an aircraft carrier with a giant collection of tubes on top. Were good, but I don't think they were nearly as... They're still a work in progress. They're still tuning that particular headphone. And they sounded good, but the really amazing story after the Orpheus was a company called Mr. Speakers. And Mr. Speakers started out with... Mr. Speakers started out doing mods for Fostex T50 RPs and then started making their own planar magnetic headphones and then decided they were going to do an actual electrostatic headphone, the Ether ES. And they are amazing. One, because they sound incredible. I think they are as good as the Orpheus. My betters tell me that the Orpheus have an edge at this point. But what's really incredible about Mr. Speakers is they're trying to make a point. And the point is they want to sell the Ether ES headphones for less than $3,000, and they want to deliver them with an amplifier that costs less than $2,000 so that you will have that $50,000 headphone experience for about $5,000, which is still about $4,700 more than probably most people are ready to pay for that are listening to the podcast. But it's really amazing to see a small U.S. company, they're down in San Diego, try to, you know, set a new standard. And they really did. They had another headphone I got a chance to listen to. the Choose Your Location, I see, if you're watching the video right now, is a little awkward on the Mr. Speaker's website because it keeps resetting. So I think we are driving our poor producer completely mad right now. But they also came out with the Aeon closed back headphone, which is very similar to their Ether C Flow. The Ether C Flow sells for $1,800. The Aeon sell for $700, and they're designed to be a travel friendly version of these amazing sounding planar magnetic headphones that Mr. Speaker makes. So it was really interesting to hear these electrostatics. It was amazing to hear this $5,000, or, you know, intended to be. They haven't done it yet, right? Because right now they were running it off of a Blue Hawaii headphone amp, which is like a $5,000-$6,000 headphone amp to run this new Ether ES. But I love the idea of somebody taking what a bunch of companies are trying to sell at $50,000 and then trying to, you know, bring it down to $5,000, which means hopefully, you know, it becomes, you know, gets down to closer to 1,000. Although when you look at the tolerances that they're going on with this, where is it? Tolerances of 0.58 millimeter on the stator gap. That's in between the diaphragm and the stator. So it is crazy how tight the tolerances are when you're building electrostatics. And part of what makes the electrostatics sound so realistic is because the diaphragm moves so fast, it can very, very accurately portray the decay of a sound, or the sort of, yes, when the sound goes from, you know, you toot the horn and the horn sort of fades out, or the cymbal fades out. And doing that accurately, if you're not controlling decay, Mr. Clark from Mr. Speakers, he said, if you're not controlling decay, you can squish low-level details. And if you overdamp it, it decays the highs too hard, and the headphone starts to sound kind of slow. So, you know, that's part of the ability to move the diaphragm so fast is something we've heard a lot about. For example, in the, you know, the Focal Utopias, you know, and with electrostatics, where they have something so light and they can move it so fast, it does an incredible job of accurately reproducing sound, which is probably more audio nerdery than anybody wanted off of Twitch. But
I'll add to it just very briefly too. Like, as somebody who's owned a pair of MagnaPans, I had the MG12s. Once you've heard electrostats, like you said, they're so fast, they're able to resolve those, not just the low level detail, it's that decay that you're talking about. It's the sounds kind of after a string has been plucked or after a horn plays a note. And it's so much different than listening to a conventional loudspeaker. It's astonishing. But you have, you know, you say you even buy like the low end MagnaPans, and I had the kind of the first step up. They're like $1,200 a pair. Then you cannot give them enough power. They will take as much power as you have. Then you start looking into, well, this amp here is like $2,000. It might be able to do it. Once you add the amp and pay for the DAC and everything else, you're spending $5,000. So the idea of electrostatic all-in-one kind of kit, where you're getting everything you need for what will actually probably end up being better sound than a pair of Maggies in your living room, because the room itself is the speaker box with that type of speaker. And then,
well, you should explain that a MagnaPlaner speaker is typically 6 feet high and 3 feet wide, and there are two of them, and they can't be up against the wall. So,
just the reason, you know, I don't own them anymore. I had a child. Now the idea of having speakers in the center of my living room that are 5 feet tall is just not practical anymore. So those are gone, unfortunately. But the idea of just having them, you know, where you can listen privately and get better bass than you'd be able to out of a smaller planar magnetic speaker, for sure, is remarkable to me. I love these less expensive planar magnetic or electrostatic headphones that are on the market.
Well, while we're moving in that direction, I got to listen to one more last year, the Triple Drivers, $99 from USA.onemore.com. is probably my favorite in-ear monitor right now. Sells for $100. It is an outrageous improvement over anything that came with your phone. And you're going to have to spend a tremendous amount of money to get a huge jump in performance. Something I'm pretty sure you heard about it at CES, the One More Quad Driver. That's the triple driver you're looking at right there, which is probably the earbud I've used most often in last year. That's the new quad driver, that second one. And they've basically stuffed three balanced armatures inside of each of those and a diamond-like carbon driver in the back. But the end result is you get a much fuller low end on those. And if you're a bass head and you're looking for something that's really going to sound bassy, not in an overwhelming, ridiculous, oh dear God, I'm the 15-year-old with the learner's permit and the 2,000, you know, watt amp and the unbolted down subwoofer in the trunk blowing the black window out of my car. But in the sense of
trunk rattle going.
Yeah, well, the trunk rattle is part of the experience, right? My next door neighbor's son was it was awesome because he was so excited. And I swear he nearly blew the trunk off of his car the first time he started up his new car stereo. And he was certainly rattling things around in the back. But those have I was listening to That's It from the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. And it's two tubas going at it for the bass line. And it was really full and rich and like being up on the stage with the tubas. And if you're not that into tubas or bass or low end or having the string section bomb in, you know, in orchestral music or being able to really fill out the bass in a jazz band, that may not be your thing. The other thing is they're twice as expensive as the triple driver. The quad drivers are currently in pre-order for $200, where the triple driver sells for $100. So that's the triple driver sells for $100. If you're watching the video, the quad driver is on pre-sale. It's going to sell for $200 and ship on April 1st. You know, I feel like it's like adding a subwoofer to a really nice set of bookshelf speakers. And if you're looking for bass, it's got a pretty good take on it. also got to listen to Vmoda's Forzas. Reviewed those in Tech Thing this week, which is Vmoda makes some really amazing, heavy-duty, stylish but excellent-sounding headphones. And a lot of their headphones tend to be very sort of V-shaped, where there's a lot of bass and there's a lot of treble. And it's not necessarily neutral, but it's really, really fun. The Forzas dialed that down a lot. It certainly is a little recessed in the mids, but it's still really pleasurable to listen to. But what's crazy about these, they have some optional, like $20 add-on 3D printed flare you can add on to them. But what's amazing about these is they are trying to build, you know, a sealed, ready to go to the gym, ready to go in the rain, ready to use on your cycle, your bicycle when you're sweating like a dog, but actually sounds really good. You know, is sports ready, gym ready, but still something an audiophile can listen to, or just somebody who likes music can listen to and not be like, ugh, these sound awful. So it's a very different take. Those are also $100, which is right there with the one more triple driver. I don't think the sort of sense of the stage was as good as the triple driver, but I also wouldn't want to take the triple drivers to the gym or out in a really, really heavy rainstorm. So, and if you haven't heard them, if you ever get a chance, the Audezee, Audezee's iSign. These are crazy. I thought the Sign, which was a very slim on-ear planar magnetic, was an amazing feat. And then I talked about these back in October at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. These are not inexpensive, but they are incredible when you think that, you know, this technology started out in like $4,000 or $5,000 headphones and has been trickling down and getting smaller. The iSign 10s are $399, and actually that's their VR version. The iSign 10s sell for $399, and they're one of the most incredible in-ear headphones I've heard, even compared to some of the incredibly expensive stuff from Jerry Harvey. But it's got that planar magnetic, that huge sound stage, that big, full, you know, tight low end. They're $50 less if you don't get the lightning cable. But they also have the iSign 20, which wraps the voice coil farther out on the diaphragm and gives it more bass and a little more clarity. And I got to say that I think the, as much as it pains me to say that if you can swing it, the $200 for the iSign 20 gives you a fantastic increase in bass. And I think it does kind of open the sound stage and make the imaging a little better. Those are pretty amazing in-ear monitors. If you're looking to spend a little bit more, but not ready to drop into the world of insanity that is the bespoke, not quite bespoke, the super headphones, the supercar super headphones, like the Shangri-La and the Sennheiser HE1. Wow, dude, I just nerded way out. Sorry.
It's okay. This has been Headphone Corner with Patrick Martin.
I'm sure we're going to get a lot of angry, raging tweets. But we'll dial it back on the headphones next week. Really crazy story I wanted to cover, and I'll quit slouching to do that. IBM researchers published in Nature. Crazy story yesterday that they have managed to read and write data to a single atom. So they take a holmium atom, which is a big fat atom with a ton of unpaired electrons. They set it on a bed of magnesium oxide. It's really wonderful. If you're not kind of into reading the full Nature article, TechCrunch is a great rewrite. They set it on a bed of magnesium oxide. And, quote, in this configuration, the atom has what's called magnetic bistability. It has two stable magnetic states with different spins. And then they use a scanning tunneling microscope to apply, quote, about 150 millivolts at 10 microamps to the atom. And that causes the holmium atom to switch its magnetic spin state. The spin states have different conductivity profiles, and the scanning tunneling microscope that they use to apply the voltage can detect which state the atom is in, which basically means they could write to a bit on an atom. So, they use a single atom to store a zero or a one, and then a pair of atoms to store the four binary combinations 00011011. You know, I just think that was fantastic.
So does this mean that storage capacities are going to just go through the roof?
I think it's going to take a while for them to, you know, right now they're talking about using a scanning tunneling microscope. And I think it'll take them a while to go from like a room full of equipment down to a hard drive enclosure. I could be wrong. This is
Let's
pretty
see.
Far out there.
They went from ENIAC, which was like the size of a small house, to
yes.
The personal computer took about 40 years. So hopefully it doesn't take that long.
Hopefully not. But when you see what a scanning tunneling microscope looks like, it's like a giant collection of tubes. Maybe not
like,
filling
like the
a
internet. it looks like the internet.
Well, I don't know how old this particular scanning tunneling microscope is, but it is a little cartoon-like. I don't know if we can get the this may have been one of the original scanning tunneling microscopes, but you know, it looks like something out of a corner of a submarine, except it's stainless steel and it has some incredibly high voltage looking wires running into it in various corners. And I'm guessing it's about 4 feet. I got to find you a bigger image, but it's, they're big. Like the size of a really big table. So I don't know what the modern ones look like, but I suspect it's going to be a while before we see this technology applied in everyday storage.
That thing looks intense.
Yeah.
All of that to successfully save one bit of data.
Hey, man. If it's the right bit of data, wouldn't you want it to be saved?
It takes more than one bit to send an emoji. That would be the ultimate test. We have successfully sent an emoji using the scanning tunneling microscope.
We have used the most sophisticated technology on the planet. I'm not even going there, man. Is there anything you could tease that's coming up on PC Purr in the next week?
Oh, we have a lot of stuff. I'm working on actually something interesting. I'm wrapping up a review of a thermal electric CPU cooler.
Really?
Which could come in handy for those Ryzen CPUs.
Like full-on piezoelectric, the layer of material that heats on one side and cools on the other?
Yeah, it's actually a hybrid design. This is from Phononic. This is their Hex 2.0 CPU cooler. And it can operate as a standard heatsink fan. It's a very compact design. It's a 95-millimeter design that uses a 92-millimeter fan. Huh. But it's very interesting. Very, very premium product, but right. Also very compact. Fits on any motherboard. I was testing it with a mini ITX build, actually. So nice. Interesting Peltier. To see exactly. Yes.
That's what I meant. Not piezo, Peltier.
Peltier cooler hybrid. So it switches to that mode when it needs to. And it has software that basically senses load and says, okay, now go ahead and enable it. Now to save power and thermals. Obviously there's a thermal component to using that type of cooling. You're generating heat to reduce right. heat, and then you have to dissipate that heat as well. So it's a very small twin tower design where they've actually worked out a way to kind of mitigate the excess heat while working efficiently. And in my testing, it's actually very effective. It's very surprisingly effective considering the size of the cooler.
What's the pricing on it like?
The full MSRP on it is $149.
Okay.
So it sounds high, but then you're basically comparing it to like a closed loop liquid solution, but you're doing it in a 95-millimeter square that will fit on any motherboard. So it's a niche kind of product, but once I actually chart out all the results, I've done all the benchmarking. I finished last night. I've got to actually look at it just from my notes, like hastily looking at these things. It's just like it performed way, way better than I thought it was going to, and way better than anything, an air solution in that size. So look for that soon.
On PC Purr. Oh my goodness. Got a review of the Nintendo Switch this week. Talk about the Brave browser on the tech thing this week. and just did a roundup talking about the new, the latest, the wallpaper TV from LG. Robert Heron got hands-on and got his meters on that and has some preliminary testing information on that. If you were curious about the W7 and want the ultimate OLED television from CES, take a look at AVXL this week. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, Sebastian, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Hey, no problem. Good to be here.
And ladies and gentlemen, we invite you to send questions. Normally, it's at Ryan Schrouder, at Patrick Norton. Sebastian, what's your Twitter handle?
At Sebastian Peak. It's very easy. Creative. If you spell Sebastian, then you can find me on Twitter.
And if you can't spell Sebastian, you can go to PC Perv, find one of Sebastian's articles, and then get the link to the Twitter.
Right.
Which is another way to do that. Oh, my goodness. Please send out your questions. We'd love to hear from you. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Sebastian Peak.
Catch you next week on Twitch.